Mike described particularly the acute threats that we face as a nation. Some of the chronic threats, though, are the volumetric cybercrime. And I look at what's happening in the UK in another example with Jaguar Land Rover and think about the 70,000 employees impacted, the 1,000 cars a day that were not manufactured, and the flow-on impact to the economy, and then the role of the government to then step in and say, at what point is the failure too big that a government has to make the step of backing industry with loans and guarantees. And for me, that's really demonstrative of the fact that Australia has had a lot of data breaches. And if you think about the confidentiality issue that Mike spoke about this morning, lots of our data has been impacted, but the integrity of the data is kind of the next step. Imagine that if there's a scenario where you're thinking about blood in a hospital and someone changes a couple of hundred of blood type for hospitals, and you can't guarantee then that you're getting the right blood. Same thing with perhaps a financial institution. So the integrity of the data is perhaps a higher order challenge to think about in terms of the threat, let alone the availability of the asset itself. And so pre-positioning of ransomware exploits on operational technology is something that we haven't seen in Australia to a large degree. But I fear, given what's happened in the UK, that's coming significantly our way. So that's kind of in a cyber perspective, lots of things we worry about. People are obviously, and it was spoken about in the last panel, people are inherently vulnerable. We've seen organisations where one in six people still click the link, perhaps that's one in two in some organisations. So people acting maliciously alternatively not understanding the security settings, people are still at the heart of some of the challenges that we face. And you add that, if you just look at the technology domain, to the traditional security threats, physical threats, supply chain threats, they're all culminating. And for us, we really think about a much more strained environment, one where risk management is at the heart of any response, from the context of how do I materially make the functioning of my business or infrastructure asset or government entity, how do I continue that into the future? How do I make sure that I can continue to provide the service? And so the threat environment for us is degrading, it is getting worse, and it's coming from multiple different places. And so I think to answer your question, pretty difficult threat environment, but I think the positive bit about what Mike spoke about earlier today is risk management is at the heart of the response. And so there are ways in which we can collectively respond to the threat.
Well, I passed to Rob there in a similar sort of theme. What does operational resilience in this world mean for JP Morgan?
Well, firstly, it's great to be here. So thank you, Simone, for the invitation. This is our sort of number one risk that we're focused on. So what we call an S1, it's one of our strategic areas that we focus on across the bank globally. We have a global approach. We spend $18 billion US on technology a year. Half of that is to, in terms of innovation, new products, new systems. The other half is to run the bank. And part of that component is around cyber and resilience. So we spend around about $800 million US on cyber alone. We see that as a good expense. You can't underspend on these types of issues. So something that we're super, super focused on and continue to invest through the cycling.
Very good. Do you find as well, do you agree with the sort of thesis though, that for all that spend, sometimes it's, as Hamish said, it's not actually a sophisticated...
I think the risks are definitely getting more rather than less.
Yeah.
I think these AI-enabled risks and threats are becoming quite prevalent. The speed to remedy is becoming really short. They're finding vulnerabilities very quickly and you've got to respond really quickly as well. So I think that the trick to this is always having it front of mind and continuing to invest into it.
So, Craig, Chair of Telstra at the front line, I guess, as we heard this morning, telecoms are seen as very vulnerable, but also hugely important to protect everything. What tips do you have for boards and directors for making sure they fulfil their responsibilities in this area?
Yes, I suspect if you asked most directors on boards in Australia, they said, which is the risk that you most worry about? A lot of directors would say cyber. And I think that's probably a pretty good answer. As the others have commented, Hamish, I think the threat vector keeps getting more and more challenging. And I think the one thing we have done very well in Australia, I think the informal and formal networks that exist between security agencies, regulators, business and government has got much, much better. It is, people often say this, but I think it's true. I mean, cybersecurity is a team sport, and it's something that, you know, we all need to work together in Australia to defend against. I think from a board's perspective, though, while it is seen as a high, very high risk, and it is seen as a risk that's perhaps more challenging to address, in a sense, the approach I'd take is it's not that different conceptually to the management of any significant operational risk you take. But obviously the board's not managing specific risks, but it has a critical role to play in governing those risks. And I suppose my learnings over time is, you know, consistent with most other risks, are you taking a risk-based approach to cyber? I mean, there's so many different ways you sometimes think about, if you look at the various ways other companies or organisations around the world have been attacked, it seems like there's almost an endless way for people to seek to probe your defences. So I think risk-based enterprise-wide approach is really important. And so what does that mean in practice? I actually had breakfast with Andy Penn this morning, a former CEO of Telstra who does a lot of work with Hamish and the government on this space, and we sort of had a very practical discussion about how boards might approach that. And I think, I mean, sounds sort of very obvious, but I think just being clear about what you're seeking to protect, I mean, what is your portfolio of digital assets, being clear on that. They have different risk weightings or different levels of risk, so being clear about, you know, what is your security posture against each of those classes of risk. I mean, how do you frame, how you manage against that risk posture that you're seeking to achieve, then implementing against that and then measuring it. And I think for boards increasingly, because it is such a constantly changing space, threats are changing all the time, that one thing that gives me more comfort as a director is involving third parties, well-informed third parties, from time to time, doing an assessment of with management, not trying to find management out, but working with management to truly assess, saying, given that risk profile, given what you're seeking to achieve against that risk profile, what are you doing and what can you improve?
Great. And what about Simone here? What do you think a board responsibility top tip should be for dealing with this from a regulatory perspective?
For the boards? Mm. Well, if managing cyber risk and dealing with it is a team sport, I think I quite like that, I would happily say, listening to the answers all day and the answers on the panel, it's a pretty well-functioning team. Because I think we see things really similarly to what's already been said and some bit what's been shared today. So I guess the key messages from ASIC's perspective would be, and we've heard this already today, firstly, like, the threat is real. It is real. It is ever-present. It is growing. It is harmful. We heard incredible numbers from Mike Burgess this morning in terms of $12.6 billion to the economy, but we might get to talk a little later about harm to individuals as well when it's coupled with a data breach. So it's real and it's harmful. And it's hard, right? It's hard, and for boards, it's hard, it's ever-changing. But as has been said, it's one of your risks to manage. You know, you have to stare into it. You have to deal with it. I think the second message would be, just as you've heard, it's not about the in the moment that you were attacked with a cyber attack. It's about, like all risk management, all running your business, the before, the during and the after, right? So think of your customers, think of your critical services, which is, of course, what boards do well and are paid to do well. And in the before, it's all the things we've just heard. What was your risk framework like? Did you identify your crown jewels? Did you know where your vulnerabilities were? Is your cyber preparedness and capability, is it match fit for what your risk appetite is and what the data is, the integrity of data that you hold and the nature of your customer base and your services? In the moment, think of those customers, think of those services, think also of those employees. We heard mention of employees before. Are you using that crisis management plan? Was it tested? Are you applying it? Are you meeting your kind of conduct and disclosure responsibilities in around those customers and services, that mindset? And then in the aftermath, what was the follow-up and follow-through in terms of the communication, the disclosure, the willingness to learn from it? So it's sort of, it's a before, a during, and an after. And I think the final messages would be, I know it's obvious, but it's not an IT risk, it's a business risk. It's part of your risk management, and good risk management means business must own it. So all leaders must be owning this, you know, across your business. And the final message would be, as part of that team sport, the regulators, the government agencies, you know, I'm with one of my colleagues here, we are all paying attention to this. And to play our part in this team sport, that will mean that we will use all regulatory tools. So on one hand, we have a very close regulatory and supervisory focus on this, and we work closely with other government agencies. On the other hand, we're required, it's been an enforcement priority for the last couple of years, if there's a real failing and there's real harm, we will hold entities to account. So in that sense, we are paying attention, we'll continue to, because as we've heard all day, there's just too much at stake.
You mentioned they're holding to account. I know you've taken action recently against about a couple of situations, but how much of a priority is it for ASIC? You know, obviously it's a pretty broad regulatory remit that you have, but, you know, key theme today, and is it top 10, top 5?
Well, I think one of the really interesting things we heard this morning is that point about 99.9% of the time it's not a surprise, yeah. Right? So it's with that mindset that we, when appropriate, as we're required to, bring all the regulatory tools, including enforcement, and you'll probably hear more from that tomorrow from our Deputy Chair. But it's actually the full suite, and you can't get a stronger priority than being in our corporate priorities. We have 5 corporate plan priorities, and cyber was present last year as part of operational risk. This year, cyber's present again as part of a number 4 on our corporate plan, operational risk resilience, you know, what today's been all about, and cyber within that, as well as our other responsibilities for operational risk in and around, for example, markets infrastructure.
Gotcha. Hamish, something Mike said this morning that surprised me was that he didn't feel like we appreciate how disruptive this could be. You know, threw some numbers around. It's always good for the Financial Times. We like numbers. But, you know, I think it did surprise me, given, you know, how many times we people sit on stage and talk about this, that there isn't an appreciation of that. Is that something that you see?
I think you used to see that. But you hear what has just been said about boardrooms. And you can tell if you're a government organisation walking into a boardroom if there's the right culture. Because people are asking the right questions, they may well have simulated the worst case scenario, have a good sense about who to contact. The worst phone calls we get is when a company is calling the government for the first time, didn't have a plan, hadn't exercised it, and is coming to it fresh. You can tell that that is a difficult first interaction with government. And so you can really tell at the Commonwealth level, we've been spending a lot of time thinking about catastrophic risk and what that might mean for the economy. And so over the last couple of years, we've identified the most highly interdependent infrastructure in the economy. We've regulated and named them and are now working together to say, how do we start to protect you because of the cascading impacts that you might have to the economy? And so we've identified those top 220 systems of national significance. We've also done the same for the government in the last couple of months. We've identified those really consequential systems of government significance. And from our perspective, if everything's critical, nothing is. But there are some systems which are so important that an outage would have such a disproportionate impact, some of those impacts that Mike talked about earlier today, and we're pretty confident that we've got the group of people ready to be able to bounce back and respond. But when you look at all of the incident response plans in isolation for each individual company, you come to the conclusion pretty quickly that a lot of the assumptions in each individual plan actually rely on the same people. And so from a holistic perspective, if we had a cascading number of cyber incidents which are starting to impact a range of different companies, and we saw a bit of this last year in CrowdStrike with the technical outage and how consequential that was with 72,000 Woolworths systems, flights in the air, that the government effectively has to use its convening power to say, who do you help first? And threat to life is always going to be the most important thing. And so we've got the balance between looking at the nation, and as Mike said, some of the threat indicators and warnings are flashing red, and then who do you prioritise first, which may mean that companies might have to fend for themselves if we have a large-scale set of different scenarios for a prolonged period of time. And I know lots of companies are putting thought into how do I think about my own energy generation? How do I think about my own water supply for a period of time? How do I think about containing and responding? And so catastrophic risk hasn't impacted this country short of natural hazards, and that's something we should always look at.
Back to you, Craig. What can you give us in terms of practical examples of good cyber hygiene practices? You talked about using third parties there, perhaps stress testing scenarios, but you know, from Telstra's perspective, given how much effort you put into this, what works, what doesn't, what benefits can you achieve?
Yeah, there's a few different things. I think one, I think Hamish and Simone have both mentioned, I just do think crisis simulations that are well designed and taken very seriously are really key learning events. I think no one really knows how bad this is until you live through one. Unfortunately, touch wood, I haven't had to as a director, but others have, and it's increasingly a greater risk going forward. So, I mean, we recently did one at Telstra, and that we had really significant learnings from them. So I think, and apart from just scaring everyone senseless, which is not a bad thing, it's again saying the obvious perhaps, but in a crisis, time matters. And so we've learned these things from discussing it with people that have been through a crisis, but I think, you know, there's an interesting balance with the board. Boards will want to take an interest and want to get across it, and they should get across some things, but they can sort of get in the way. And sometimes you need to make, I'm taking that with the greatest respect for my peers and myself, but that doesn't mean it's not good intent or they can't add value, but you've got to move at speed. And so if you've got to make a decision, do I lock this system down, which might be a pretty big call, maybe I haven't got time and every hour counts, so I need to move really quickly. There are other decisions that you wouldn't want to make without the board in the room. And also the communication, it's not a time to inform or educate a board in a sense. The board wants to know what's the consequence of what's happened. Can we really get our heads around that? Have we been able to cauterise and halt the risk? And where do we go forward? So I think that's another important thing. And similarly with that simulation, it's not the first time you want to be introduced to some of your talent in that space. Because you've really got to trust each other, right? And so when you're in a crisis and someone's saying, well, we should do this, if it's the first time you're meeting someone in your cyber team, I'm suggesting it is, it's not ideal, right? So again, and talent are everything. I mean, as a board, on so many different things, if you've got the right talent with the right culture and the right mindset, you know, you're halfway there. So, and that's sometimes not easy for a board to judge. Have you got the right skill sets in cyber? And of course, it goes beyond cyber because, I mean, the cyber team can only do so much. And one thing a board can do is you can take an enterprise view. So if you're sitting in and having a cyber discussion with a board or a risk committee, often there's trade-offs and there's priorities that need to be made. And sometimes, you know, the CEO in the end and the senior team should make those, but boards can give a different perspective. And it's another way of highlighting, you know, do you really understand each other's sense of the risk appetite of an organisation? So, I mean, there's a lot of different things I can talk about, but I do think crisis simulations are really important, and I just do think the talent that you have in your organisation is critical.
And do you think it's important to have cyber experience on the board, perhaps people who've lived through one or people that from that industry? Does that bring with it an obvious benefit, or can that bring with it baggage that isn't helpful?
I think it's a really good question, and to be honest, I'm not sure I know what the right answer is. That's something that I think as chairs around the business environment constantly discuss. And, you know, as a board at Telstra, we do this more regularly, but we have a formal annual discussion at the end of our strategy board session on board capability set. And we try and look forward and saying, well, given the strategy of the company, given the risks we face in delivering on that strategy, have we got the right capability set around the board table? And that's an important discussion because I think the days where we're sort of getting onto a different topic, the days where you had boards, I'm on the Telstra board, we don't have a term limit, but term limit's 10 years, so I'm there for 10 years. I you might have directors that do stay on the board for that time, but you might have directors that are only there 3 or 6 years, and they might be perfectly good directors, but your strategy's changing, the environment's changing, so the skill set you need on your board needs to change and needs to be more dynamic, just as you'd expect of a senior management team. We talk about this constantly, and the pro is you've got someone with deep experience who can perhaps ask questions that maybe you can only go so far with more general experience on the board. The negative is maybe you've got a director that can only swim in that lane, Maybe they have very strong views on some technologies. You know, they can get out of date very quickly. So I don't know there's any right or wrong on board capability set. I think each board needs to think about that. But that's why, I mean, in our experience, almost every director on the board has to have a reasonable level of understanding on cyber. You just do. Yeah. And so how do you educate yourselves as a board? And then, you know, if you feel like whatever reason you're not going to have a sort of so-called expert on your board, that's where I think you can draw on expertise in a different way. You can have a board advisor. You can have regular reviews where you get real experts in who you might argue, if I get a really international, renowned expert on cybersecurity who's going to sit down with the organisation and grill them and understand them, maybe doing that is better than a board can ever do apart from its other obligations. So it's not a black or white answer, but I just think it depends.
Oh, that's good. Rob, from a JP Morgan perspective, do you have simple messages you can share about operational resilience? And I'm wondering as well, it's sort of like the Australian leg of a large global company, so you probably take quite a lot of learnings and expertise from other parts of the empire, right?
Yeah, sure. I think a company's approach to risk is foundational, right? It speaks to the culture of the organisation. I think Hamish used that word. I think that is absolutely correct. I think these types of risks, you should never become complacent. You should never get comfortable. You know, the expression that we use locally is that hubris is corporate kryptonite. If you're starting to feel comfortable about these risks, you need to reassess. The tone definitely has to come from the top, but it has to go deep into the organisation, and that speaks to that cultural point. So one of our key pillars that we talk about in how we do business is around operational excellence. Act like an owner. Own the risk. Don't walk past it. Be thinking about what's happening upstream and downstream. So I think that it's a multifaceted approach. Everything that we do on a global framework. So there is consistency across the organisation. A lot of what we've been talking about is the interconnectedness of markets. The Australian market becoming more global, more players coming into this market as well. So having that sort of global perspective, learning from what's happening offshore, learning what's happening domestically and applying it to our offshore framework as well. Simone talked about critical services. You have to start by understanding what are your critical services. Who are your third-party dependencies? Framing tests and simulations around that and testing constantly, and then learning from those because this you can't stand still, and then constantly upgrading the framework that you have. So it's multifaceted. It's not just one thing, and you have to come at it from many different directions.
Very good. Simone, what's ASIC's view of operational resilience and what you want to say?
Goodness. Yeah, I'm conscious there's, you know, a number of familiar faces in the room who understand this is probably a reflection on me personally. But I think this is a gift of a question, and especially to follow on from that answer, things like think like a principal, don't walk past it, line one, own the risk. Like, that is deep and really important. As an ASIC commissioner, I sit here and I would say, goodness, so much comes back to operational risk and resilience within that. So much bad can come from it, so much good can stem from it as being foundational. And interestingly, I reckon I could give you a dozen examples of current engagements or actions that look like they're really different. Root cause, operational risk mismanagement. Equally, in my old job before this, I was CRO for a division of a great big bank, and I had really big financial risk delegations. One thing the Group Chief Risk Officer and I agreed on, and it sounds like I think maybe JPM would agree on, is actually so much of financial risk that manifests is just operational risk that's been mismanaged. Seriously, like probably 80% of the time. So it's primacy, right? It's primacy in what we do and how you think about things. So simple rules, I think, for what good looks like. Maybe the time horizon thing again, and a little bit of it came through in Craig's answers as well. Like, if you've got operational risk management match fitness in a moment of crisis, you know what to do, and you've got the right people in the right roles, the right systems and processes to respond. So I think in the preparation, the number one rule, actually, I would say, is before you extend your risk appetite, before you extend your geographic footprint, before you introduce more complex products, make sure your operations are sound and sustainable to support that, right? And by operations, I mean broadly. You've got the governance, you've got the capability, you've got the roles, you've got the reporting before you do it. In the moment of running the business, I think that from board down and through, prize a risk culture that prizes the management and the principal mindset about owning operational risk management. It's part of good and proper operations. Think about your customers, think about your critical services. And then I think in the moment of crisis, if there is, you know, an operational risk management event, put those customers first, put those services first. And actually, if you're doing that, you will be putting your regulatory responsibilities in amongst that, because that's part of that conduct, part of that disclosure. And then make sure, you know, you're operating that framework that you've got, and then you're learning and following up and following through and owning it. If it went wrong, learn from it, remediate, address it with that service delivery and customer first mindset. And it might seem really basic, but actually I think that's the principles that allow Telstra board to be able to sit there and go, well, in a crisis, we won't necessarily get in the way of some of those key decisions that need to be made quickly. Why can they do that? Because they've got an operational risk management framework that's clearly got a sense of accountability. So if somebody makes a decision, they know they've got to own it, and if it goes wrong, there'll be accountability. There's transparency around how decisions are made, how they'll be reported and followed through. And there's a consistency around what operations should and do look like. I think those sort of principles that are good operational risk management, plus, as Rob said beautifully, that principle mindset of owning the risk and not walking past it. If companies, big and small, all sorts of entities, whether they're licensed, whether they're companies, whether they're banks, whether they're super funds, whether they're SMEs, if they understand their risks and use those principles, then I think we'd have a lot less to deal with at ASIC.
So it sounds like they're an issue there. So you're nodding there, Hamish. I mean, how important do you think owning or accountability is in these scenarios?
Oh, really important. I think one of the observations I've made is that there's a different language between often security professionals, the CEO and the board. And the ability to break down, particularly when it relates to technology and cyber risk, you can move down a pretty technical path pretty quickly. And so when you go back to the question you asked about technical capability on the board, I think actually the responsibility is on the chief risk officers, on the chief security officers, on the CISOs, to try and quantify risk in a non-technical way. And that's a real big challenge. And then on the top of that, to try and talk in economic terms around what an investment would mean in terms of an added protection or an added benefit to the technology. And I think that's a missing bit that we see breaks down. And then it gets worse. A lot of companies and government agencies structurally separate cyber and security. And so thinking about all hazard security in a different way, you can't manage people risk in one area and technology risk in another and supply chain risk in another. Viewing it all together as business risk, I think, is the way to think about what would materially impact the functioning of my enterprise and how do I start to put in place layers of protection. And so I think the advice that you've got from the panel around understanding what you're trying to protect not only goes to the technology estate, it goes to the people, it also goes to the supply chains, as was mentioned, but then goes upstream around what are the types of scenarios that are possible, plausible, and then probable? And how do we start to put in those layers of protection and to what standards? And for God's sake, please don't write an incident response plan in the middle of an incident. Have it exercised and make sure that that's a culture in the organisation, and then constantly review it because it's always changing. And so I think that they're all basic operational resilience, risk, security principles that you're right, Simone, we see time and time again break down in different layers. And sometimes it's structural, sometimes it's a language thing, sometimes it's not putting the risk together. And I think there's elements of all of that that we can do collectively much better as a country.
That's a very good point about security and cyber sitting together, and sort of almost surprising to hear. But, you know, is that sort of underneath one accountable person, do you find? Or are they literally reporting into different places and have completely different
It's interesting.
Responsibilities?
I think A CISO is traditionally put in the IT part of an organisation and has links across to broader security issues. But when you see people appointing chief risk officers and bringing the whole risk together, you actually change the discussion from functional lines to risk and operational resilience issues. And I think that's a really important step change for everyone to think about. How do you fundamentally not view cyber security risk as something done by someone else? Cybersecurity risk is done by everyone, including the CISO, but everyone holds a risk. And if you look at some of the cyber incidents, particularly those that are increasingly AI-generated, we envisage a scenario where you could be talking to your boss on a video, which is a deep fake in the future. And if that's a scenario that we haven't equipped people to understand what risk that's opening up, that's a major challenge that we're going to face, which gets back to people risk and technology risk. Mm. And that has to be viewed holistically. And if that's coming our way, it's a pretty dangerous environment.
Yeah. I might go back to Rob now and ask what you think the current state of resilience across Australia's financial markets is, particularly in the context of operational risk. Obviously, it's a myriad sector.
I would say it's untested. You know, we've had outages. We have not had a catastrophic failure where you have multiple outages and one thing after another after another after another. We've had a series of, you know, an outage here, an outage there, and the market's recovered. So I would say the answer is it's untested, and I think you need to have that sort of nervous energy about this type of topic because we don't want, obviously, that to happen, but, you know, we need to be preparing for it. I think in many ways the regulators are actually leading the way globally. I think, you know, the market integrity rules that ASIC's put out, I think CPS 230, CPS 234, are great guardrails for the industry to operate under. But I'll go back to Craig's original phrase. This is a team sport, right? There are so many people involved. There's financial market infrastructure at play. There is cloud providers. There are smart router ordering systems. There's technology everywhere that's interconnected, local markets, global markets. We are all in it together. It's great that we as a firm spend a ton of money on this, but this is a massive ecosystem in which we're all operating. And it'll be the weakest link that will be the vulnerability. And we should all have that, as I keep saying, this nervous energy around it, because we're all in it together.
Absolutely. A question basically for the panel, but you know, we're talking about boards and Craig set that off very well, but curiosity engagement on these issues, can you share examples of what good actually looks like? And we talked about sort of crisis planning and that sort of thing, but and we all read about when not good happens, but what does good look like, and what are the red flags?
Yeah, well, so I think you know, there's a very technical aspect to this risk, but like a lot of risk management, it's cultural and behavioural as well. So I think, in essence, maybe one of the most significant contributions a board can make on risk management is the tone that they set and the standards they set. And, you know, Rob talked about ownership, and the board also has to own the risks and wants to make sure it sets standards around accountabilities and ownership that are reflected in the management team. But also, I mean, you want to set an environment where it's safe to speak up as well. So there's that balance between holding people to account and wanting people to take things very seriously, and of course they must do that, with also you want a very open and transparent culture. The last thing you want to be in a boardroom is when you're discussing this thing and, you know, people are holding back and, you know, someone sitting in one part of the organisation and saying, well, I don't really agree with that, and we need to have that discussion. So I think that there's a cultural dynamic to this, and that's, again, I think that's where the board sets the tone. And it does that on operational risk more generally, and their arguably a lot of these operational risks are independent, but also they're very interdependent. So this is a point I'm taking made before about boards to some extent have a capacity to see across the organisation and with the CEO can help prioritise things. So, for example, one of the biggest challenges in cybersecurity is technology debt or legacy systems. They're just so much harder to protect than technology that's not in that state. Now, what causes that to be? I mean, it differs in different businesses, but most legacy systems exist because your product management disciplines are not as current or you're not leaning into them as much as you can. So, I mean, you wake up one morning and say, well, my cyber risk is not where it wants to be because we've got all these legacy systems, and the reasons you've got those legacy systems. Now, they can interplay together really neatly where the cybersecurity risk gets so great that you have to lean into that. But I suppose the point I'm making is they are interdependent, and decisions you make in other areas of operational risk will make it easier for you in cyber.
So, Mike, do you have a view on what board curiosity and leadership can do?
I absolutely agree with Craig's point about tone from the top. You know, risk is important, that principal mindset, that focus on operational risk. I think there's two extensions to that. One would be, sometimes we hear about boards asking questions, and the asking questions, that's important, but it's also important that they have a reasonable basis for relying on the answers. So it's, what have you done to make sure you got the right person? I think we heard before, you don't want to get to know your CISO in the crisis. How do you know they're the right person? You know, did you take the right, did you engage on the right appointments, the right people into the right role? Another example is boards might adopt frameworks, and I've worked in organisations that have been under both, you know, Central 8, there's NIST, there's others. Okay, but look behind that. Don't just look at that tick the box. What does that mean? You know, and you just heard that. It's sort of parts of these. You break these down, they're quite simple things. It's about your tech debt. Is there ageing? Is there a vulnerability there? Can you no longer patch it because it's old? So that integrating with all of that business and risk management decision, I think, is a tone from the top. And I think a final point is reminding your people who are running the business with you of why this matters. So what, go back to that customers and services. Like, why does this matter? And I think there, as a regulator, since, you know, joining the regulatory side of things, we probably get insights into that that can make it real. On one hand, you know, obviously you can't get better than our opening speaker today talking about that economic cost, but then I think the human cost as well. And something that's been stark for me, around a year ago I started working with industry were great in this regard, working with us, like stockbroking industry and others and those in financial markets, but around the problem of share sale fraud. So share sale fraud is a way, it's an example of where cyber risk meets data risk, people's details get leaked, and actually because of how much wealth is, you know, a nation of investors, particularly retired people and aged people, those who might be more vulnerable to these things, their money's sitting there, and I'm not talking about scams, I'm talking about fraud. You know, we're being stolen through the system, through operational vulnerabilities, but it's starting with cyber. A cyber breach leading to data breach, and that's when we saw a spike in this. And there's some people at ASIC have worked really hard on this with us to drill into this and deal with it. But I think for boards, there is an element, the customers and services, but also making real why and the harm. Because I can tell you, I've spoken directly to some of the victims of those share sale frauds, and some nearly lost literally their entire retirement share portfolio, and, you know, marriages and confidence almost breaking down for people in their 80s and 90s, right? And that's the human face of the victims of what we're talking about here. I think sometimes making that live can bring a bit more purpose to, rather than a, we're using NIST or we're using Essential 8, you know, this is not about compliance, this is very real.
Yeah, well, it's a good point because I guess we talk about these big thematics and threats and often doesn't connect necessarily to what we're talking about. And I always go back to, I was a telecoms reporter and we had a situation in the UK where, yeah, exactly that. You know, company shares fell and everybody wrote about it, but yeah, it was in the next week when pensioners had their details used to con them, people pretending to be from the telecoms company, that the real pain came through, I think. And I guess, you know, Craig, do you think boards sort of appreciate that? I mean, you probably spend so much time on the operational resilience side that...
Oh, yeah, no, I think... Look, every board's different, but I think people people understand at boards that what they do, the companies there, I mean, Telstra, the network's pretty critical to, you know, almost everyone in Australia, and it affects their lives, and the security and reliability of the network's really important. It is to defence and companies. So, yeah, I think boards understand that that's real and it has a significant impact. Mm-hmm. I think they get that and take it very seriously.
That's good to hear. Excellent. And Hamish, what's your view about the sort of the converse, perhaps, of what we're hearing there about when attention is lacking? Whether it's boards, whether it's management, aren't paying attention to these issues.
Yeah, as I said before, you can tell when you walk into a board if it's the first time a CISO is having a conversation with a board, and you're like, this is odd that it took the government to come and talk to you about security risk before you've had this conversation. And it's a completely different discussion and dynamic compared to an organisation where you've gone in and you know that they've had those conversations. What's even better, though, is where, and you asked what's an example around what you think good looks like. I went to an exercise with a top company and was invited into their boardroom to war game a scenario which was effectively a catastrophic incident on the company. Then walk out, and another company had a real-life cyber incident. And I saw the CEO reach out to that other CEO and say, how did you deal with that so quickly? I'm not sure we could have done that. What are the key learnings? Are you happy to come and talk to us about that? And I think that's what good looks like, where others are lifting each other up. And where you kind of go insular and ignore the problem, and you are just hoping that you won't be hit by a cyber incident, that's where real danger happens. And I think that they're polar opposites. And what really bad looks like, and I'll give you an example of that. I walked into a company and said, how are you managing your cyber risk? They're like, oh, we don't have anything connected to the internet. I said, oh, okay, sure, that's good. What about the SCADA system that underpins that big, I won't tell you which sector, that big infrastructure asset? They're like, oh, yeah, but someone else does that. I'm like, oh, who does that? Like, oh, we outsource that risk. I'm like, but that's a risk to you and to the functioning of your infrastructure asset. And they said, yeah, but, you know, we've outsourced it, so we've outsourced the problem. And I think that's what bad looks like, yeah. Where you've outsourced the problem and you're not contemplating what
really
risk
bad.
You might hold. They did claim there was a manual override, and I shouldn't worry too much, but got to say, that's what catastrophic looks like when you don't look at the risk.
Very good. Just out of interest, I mean, that's one example, but do you think that's very prevalent? We're all laughing, but as we found with CrowdStrike and various other things, sometimes, you know, the issues can be a lot more underlying than perhaps we would appreciate.
Well, I think what I'd say is everyone is different, and every sector of the economy is different. So there are more inherently challenging parts of the health sector, which is disaggregated, has lots of Internet of Things connected devices, which has lots of people walking in and out of hospitals and healthcare facilities, have really sensitive data. That's a much more difficult risk to manage than a data centre that you've effectively worked out and built it from secure by design from the base up. So they're completely different. And I think that the discussion about particularly resilient security is improving and getting much better in many sectors. But in some, cost pressures do face them. And the challenge is often, on first blush, people kind of think it's exponentially difficult. But then you talk them through, what are you trying to protect? Who has access to it? What are the systems that underpin it? And you logically take people through it. And often, and I go to hospitals quite frequently, given the threat that might pose to the nation, they're doing a lot. They just don't realise in a conceptual sense about bringing it all together and realising we do have access controls, background checks. We do have systems maintenance. We do have disaggregation between IT and OT. So we actually have some of the foundations. But putting it all together and putting that view to boards and CEOs, that's often, not always, often the missing bit.
And I'll just clarify, in terms of laughing, I think we're laughing with the nervous energy that Rob was encouraging us to have.
Absolutely. Over to Rob. What's your general outlook of the market at the moment, and what are the major risks facing the financial markets, both Australia and globally? And I guess where does cyber sit? Because you know, we're sitting here talking about it and it's priority, but you know, as we said at the top of the day, you know, there's sort of a relentless amount of change and challenge at the moment. So, you know, how does it all fit in for JP Morgan?
Well, before I answer that, just on the question on boards, I think board composition is critically important. I think you have to have people with broad experience, great, a lot of diversity on the board. People have, you know, board members have got to get out of the boardroom as well, and they've got to get into the business, and they've got to ask really challenging questions and not be satisfied with just the first answer that they get, but sanity check everything that they're hearing. And really sort of get into the trench of all of the businesses and not outsource the responsibility to others. I think it's really important. You know, we've got Jeannie Romedy, who's ex-CEO of IBM on the board, and Mark Weinberger, ex-CEO of EY on the board, and they ask really challenging questions and they get into business meetings, they get outside the boardroom. And I think it's a really healthy thing to be able to do. In terms of what's the outlook going forward, are you asking me in terms of market directions or in terms of risks or both?
Wherever you want to take it.
Okay, fine.
we'll talk about risk, I guess. So that seems.
Well, I think you know the trends that we've been talking about are going to continue, right? These are persistent. They're not going away. I think the utilisation of technology is just the speed of uptake is going to increase. The speed of innovation is going to increase. And every time you have a technology change, you have added and new risks that come around. So your risk framework has to be fluid and flexible and constantly changing. So I don't think that's going to go away. Mm-hmm. I don't think the environment in which we operate at the moment in terms of geopolitical risks are going to go away at all. Either. So over the next sort of 12, 24 months, I think all of the issues that they're facing today probably amplify. We've got a lot of market risks in front of us at the moment. Let's see what the US Supreme Court rules regarding these tariffs that are in place. I mean, that's going to create a lot of volatility in the market if the tariff regime that's currently in place, the EPAC, gets cancelled. I'm sure the administration will figure out a new way to work something out, but that's going to create additional volatility into the market and risks as well. We haven't talked about public-private markets either. That is a fundamental shift that is taking place in financial markets. You are seeing the shrinking of public markets and the growth of private markets at a rate never seen before. You're seeing the democratisation of capital. Retail investors want to be involved in these private markets. They want to be involved in all of these new technologies that we're talking about, and rightly so. But what's the right mechanism? What's the right framework for them to invest into these spaces? So I think all of the stuff that we've been speaking about and the speakers before probably persist for the foreseeable future. I think we've got a very interesting dynamic playing out globally at the moment between Australia and the US. We are likely domestically here to be on hold from a rates perspective. Our view is rates will be on hold at 3.6% for all of next year. Counter to that, we think the US is going to cut rates, one in December, one in January, and put the Fed fund rate at 3.5%. Aussie dollar will go stronger if that plays out. So there is a lot of dynamics that are playing out as well. You've got the regulatory regime in the US that's starting to come off a little bit. How as a global firm do you manage that disconnect between different markets in a market where 54% of financial assets reside in the US? So I think there's a lot of complexity. I don't think that goes away. I think Australia is in a particularly good spot. When you look at things like debt to GDP levels and some of the triple-digit percentages that countries have, and we sitting at sort of sub 40%, I think we're in a pretty good place. I think some of the supply chain gaps that the US has, plays to our strength as well. We've signed that agreement in principle around critical minerals, which I think is fantastic. So I'm cautiously optimistic. We have just signed off on our 2030 business plan for the Australian business, and we've got some very strong growth targets over the next 5 years. I think there's some good opportunities in the market here, but as I say, we are cautiously optimistic, and I don't think the risk framework changes.
Very good. So you're nodding there, Simone. We won't ask your rates outlook, but what's your view about that?
I think your question was about risks, which is important to distinguish from worries, especially when you're ASIC. So risks have both opportunities and potential for harm if not managed. So if we think about risks, like Rob's answer, one of the number one risks at the moment to be managed, and I say to be managed, and in some of these risks, I think we've got this in Australia. We've got a really great chance. I'm an optimist like Rob, but I would say the geopolitical outlook, right? It's the kind of whole point of the opening, and I won't labour that because with who I'm sitting with and who you've already heard from today, there are better placed people to talk about that. But it's very real, and it focuses us on resilience. Then if you kind of step it down to ASIC and what we focus on, confident, informed participation in markets, effective, efficient financial system and growth, I think, as Rob mentioned there, like we're at a point of, I know this is hackneyed, but the most extraordinary change. Like if you think about the questions we've got to process, right? So all day we've been hearing about like nervous energy and not being complacent, but we're processing like what is a fundamental shift in market dynamics, the public-private that Rob mentioned and we've spent a lot of time on and we'll probably talk about tomorrow. What does that mean, you know, processing that? What does it mean that liquidity is now in completely different quarters for completely different reasons to what they used to be? What does de-dollarisation mean and how does it fit with the rates environment just mentioned then? And we've talked about AI, better qualified people than me talk about AI, but sitting behind that, we've got the CapEx boom off the back of that. But then what happens if the CapEx boom and the energy needed for it and energy security doesn't keep pace with that? Like, these are like phenomenal questions. And even domestically, what's it going to mean when superannuation overtakes the others as the most important part of our financial services system, both in size outright and actually for individuals when it becomes the most important asset, not second most important asset. So processing these questions is going to take so much maturity, and we've heard today and completely agree we've got to do it quickly. We've got to do it quickly and do it with that opportunity mindset. And then if you come back to, you know, these are really new questions and risks, and yet there's some things that just feel like still the same, and that's the transmission mechanisms, right? Rob rightly touched on financial markets infrastructure. There's a transition mechanism, always was, probably always will be. Will they be resilient? You know, how the system is linked in terms of financial engineering and leverage, will the risk management around that, will our ability as regulators to look at data and understand what the stress might be in a stress scenario, will that be resilient? So I think there are some really significant risks, and it's a risk in itself. There's so much to process. There are some old and hardened risks that are untested in terms of that transmission. And then bringing it really right back to the domestic context, we're all focused, and Anthony Miller was encouraging this as well. We've got to seize the opportunity. We can't be complacent. We've got this productivity and growth challenge that everyone's throwing out. So how do we take off vested interest hats and come together as a system to deal with those risks as opportunities, bring it together? And coming back to probably my favourite part of the ASIC Act, and, yeah, I talked about operational risk favourites and ASIC Act favourites, but favourite part of the ASIC Act, which is confident informed participation, which suggests access. So how do we ensure that in all of this there is access both for investors, as a nation of investors, but also for entities wanting capital? A lot of the themes we've talked about today feel quite institutional. What about the rest of the economy? You know, small, medium-sized enterprises are going to be part of the growth. So, as I said, this is not my worries because I think we've got this and we're dealing with these questions now and we're playing our part in that. But I think this is the risk, is there is so much coming together at once.
Right. We've got a minute left, so I'm going to throw to Hamish because you mentioned AI, Simone. You talked about deepfake videos and AI. We've been talking about cyber resilience, operational resilience. How do you think that's going to change everything given the rate of change and the euphoria around what the possible is, you know, if you're you know, paddling to keep up with the cyber threat and the resilience story, then, you know, what would you recommend companies do?
Well, it sounds like we're trying to end on a positive note. So I think despite the challenges that AI bring, the basic security settings and response are adequate to respond to AI. And so if we think about our core fundamental security settings, they should be able to respond to any technological challenge, including AI. We've just got to approach it with an open mind. And so I think using and not fundamentally changing the basic security settings is our number one piece of advice.
Perfect timing. Well, thank you very much to my panel. Very different perspectives on a very thorny issue. Really appreciate that. Reiterate, please use the app to rate our sessions so we can see how we're doing up here. And the detail of the next, well, it's changing now, we're going to elective sessions. So yes, the details of where you choose to be in about 25 minutes is up on the screen here. You've got a variety of subjects there to split up the group and focus on what you want. So see you then.